Ellie, now on RN Summer, it's downloadable on your various devices. I think you can get it on your microwave oven. And I'm talking to psychologist and Professor Adrian Furnham about how to cope with the dark side of people at work. The book, Backstabbers and Bullies. I'm a connoisseur of book titles, but rarely have come across one quite as cajoling as Backstabbers and Bullies, How to Cope with the Dark Side of People at Work. And I understand, Adrian, that you wanted to make the title even tougher. You wanted to add bastards to Backstabbers and Bullies.
Yes, I did. Unfortunately, my publisher thought that certain sensibilities would be upset, so it persuaded me to take the third B out of the title. But I think it would have helped the sales.
Well, don't delete expletives tonight. This is our last night of freedom on this program. I should point out that Adrian is professor of psychology at University College London, adjunct professor of management at the Norwegian School of Management. And the book, published by Bloomsbury, is a very useful how to deal with psychopaths and narcissists. Generally, your focus is on people at the top of companies, Adrian.
Yes, I think what I discovered a few years ago, if you look at books on leadership, is that they all nearly all fall into the sort of heroic model of leadership. Indeed, there are 70,000 books of the leadership with leadership in the title in the British Museum.
You're kidding.
Yes, it's amazing. If you read one each day for the rest of your life, you wouldn't get through them all. And most of them are amazingly simplistic in the way in which they say you leaders go about their businesses. And also, they nearly always portray a model of, the heroic leader that leads the company to success and glory and profitability and so forth. And yet we know from the newspapers on a daily basis that a great number of leaders fail and derail. We know, for instance, there are over 30 American CEOs in prison.
Only
30, yes. I'm a bit out of date. There probably should be a few more by now. But the idea is that, there's a sort of an unspoken secret in all this, and that is a huge number of supposedly very successful leaders, people who have been selected and promoted to high office in many public and private companies, actually fail and derail. They cause mayhem. They cause people to leave. The profit price goes down. The companies even close. That's what the book's all about.
My guest has written over 1,000 scientific papers and 70 books, and he's a pundit at the Sunday Times. Adrian, one of the questions you pose in your preface is how deeply dishonest, egocentric and flaky characters rise to positions of power and responsibility. I would make the observation that a great many of them rule countries. How do they manage this?
Well, I think they manage it for two reasons. One is the problem of what I call the select-out problem, that when you ask people about how they go about selection, they tell you that they have a number of these things they usually call competencies, and they look for evidence of these competencies. So you have to be honest and inspiring and blah, blah, blah. And they look for evidence of these competencies. Well, that's fine, except there's another box, and that is the sort of people you don't want. You have to select the people you do want and select out the people you don't want. Now, what very few people organizations do is they have no list and no person who's their responsible for looking for these characteristics that people don't want, like excessive mischievousness or boldness, which we might call a psychopath or narcissist. And because nobody does this, those people who, if they are intelligent and articulate and good-looking, that these characteristics they have along with those persuade selectors to select them. And it's only after they climb up the greasy pole through their deviousness that these errors are discovered.
I'd like the fact that you tossed in the term good-looking. I spent decades in the corporate world and noticed an inordinate number of corporate heads were, in fact, they look like they'd come from central casting. Is male pulchritude, or even for its female counterpart, a significant factor in getting up that greasy pole?
I think it is. I mean, there's some amazing data on height, for instance, that I can't remember the exact details, but it's something like this, that for every inch you're over 5'10", you get paid $20,000 more in your lifetime, or something like that. It's also true of women. We know every American president has been taller than average, except Jimmy Carter. By and large, more politicians have their hair than the average male of that age. And I think, you know, good looks helps, but it certainly helps in the interview, despite the fact that people have been warned not to take that into consideration.
But it happens. You know, I've been involved in interviewing job applicants for you know, decades, and no matter how hard one tries to be objective, even good old-fashioned smarmy charm and unctuous flattery is very hard to resist.
Yes, no, indeed. And if you put along with that a charming articulateness, which comes up from intelligence, if you're good-looking, articulate, and charming, then the interview is a very easy place to get away with a lot of stuff, particularly if nobody's alerted to looking into your CV and your background for evidence of all these dark side traits.
I'm talking to Adrian Furnham, who has bad news, and that is the meek do not inherit the earth, the Machiavellians do. Let me quote you. It is tough at the top, often very difficult to get there. Unfortunately, the evolutionary selection method for finding those who can make it often favour the selfish, unethical showman rather than the wise leader. Adrian, how can one identify, let's flip this over, how can one identify a potentially wise leader?
Well, yes, that is difficult. I think the answer is by, of course, looking into a person's past. We are all, adults are rather good at interviews, and narcissistic psychopaths really rather enjoy them and do well. But they are often very clever at covering up their past. And when we get evidence of these CEOs who fall from grace dramatically, and somebody does a bit of investigative journalism, what you find is all the clues to their bad habits were there for the looking, but we never searched them out. I've published another book called Revealed recently, which shows how much you can scrape off the web for a reasonably well-known person to see some of the amazing stuff that's in their background. So what I suggest is that when selecting somebody, what one does is one telephones and has a structured interview with 10 or 12 people that have worked for them in the past. By and large, you'll get a coherent picture from people who will hopefully tell you the truth of somebody, which will give you the evidence of their wisdom or lack thereof.
I can think of examples in my experience where people have actually given an appalling person a good reference to hope to ensure they never come back again.
Come back, indeed. I think that's why references are by and large a waste of time. I think people, first of all, they select people who they think will give a good reference for them. And referees, in many organizations these days, you're not allowed to give references. You're sued if you do what you've said, i.e. give a good reference to somebody who is no good, or sued if you tell the truth. And so many organizations simply forbid it. They don't, however, necessarily forbid you answering interview questions. So just the other day, I was telephoned by an august institution about a friend of mine and given it was more like a half an hour, pretty rigorous interview about what I knew about this individual. And I quizzed them afterwards, and they said they were doing this to 10 or 12 people. And I thought that was a good investment. It wasn't terribly expensive from them in terms of time or money, but they got others supposedly objective or at least experiential views on the leadership and abilities of this individual. That's the way forward, I think.
One of the things I do, and I don't know whether it makes any sense at all, it just seems to work for me, is I like to ask people what books they read or what movies they like. You know, things like that, just to sort of flesh out their the panoramic nature of their psychology.
I think that's a good reason for a number of points of view. One, of course, is that it puts them off, that they haven't prepared the answer to that question. In a rather famous question, Tony Blair was asked if he believed in God, and he stumbled over the answer because the people who were helping him on the PR didn't tell him what to answer to that. And, of course, you know, it's not easily obvious what is a good book or a good movie to create a good impression. We know that interviews are a sort of smoke and mirrors of lies and deceit. In fact, for both people, often the people tell lies about their organization and the candidates tell lies about themselves. You're not getting much useful information. But to get somebody to have to, on the spot, give an answer to a question where they want to put themselves forward as a highly desirable candidate, I don't frankly know what I would say I'm reading at the moment or what film I like in order to give that desirable answer.
The pioneers of the dark side of personality are Robert and Joyce Hogan. They've explained management derailment by using psychiatric personality disorders. Now, there is one that is termed eagerness to please. Why is that a disorder?
Yes, it's called dependent personality disorder. It's because people put the other people forward the whole time rather than themselves. They are utterly selfless, selfless to the extent that they can be abused by Machiavellians and others. It's a personality disorder which is not associated with leadership success, as you would imagine, because leaders are not interested in pleasing others, they're interested in pleasing themselves. Now, not all of the personality disorders are associated with leadership, and that is one which is almost strongly negatively associated with climbing the greasy pole of corporate life.
Adrian, this is a risky question, but do you know of any well-known corporation which does the procedure particularly skillfully?
I do. I'd rather not name names. Where organizations are very concerned with security issues and people at the top having power, and particularly power of, with secrets, then they do this very carefully and very, very well.
This is when you were a consultant to MI5, Adrian.
Well, possibly. I don't think that says that in my. In fact, we're sitting very close to MI5 at the moment in my office here. But yes, it's organisations. I mean, I'll give you an example. Pharmaceuticals would be an organisation where that equally applies. So, in these instances, people know that, you know, leadership derailment is very, very costly. Oh, I thought of another very good example, and that, of course, is the military. I was dealing the other day with a nuclear submariner. Now, if you're going to select somebody to run a nuclear submarine, this person has enormous power and enormous responsibility. And the officials selecting these individuals, who might spend 4 or 5 months underwater in an extraordinary environment, are very, very careful to check out the dark side of people because they know the imminent dangers. It's always a puzzle to me why big organizations, big corporates don't do this. It's not that expensive. It's not that problematic. But they just haven't got into the habit
of selecting out. And if you get it very wrong, and you happen to be running an airline like Lufthansa or perhaps Malaysian Airlines, you are putting people at immediate and urgent risk.
Indeed. There are, yes, I think so. Well, you're putting everybody at risk who works for the organization, because an organization can collapse and collapse quite quickly, and all of those people become unemployed.
The successful corporate psychopath, Adrian, must know they are psychopaths so they can control themselves to a certain extent.
Yes. There's been a number of books on successful psychopaths. They're called the industrial psychopath these days. And a rather good book called Snakes and Suits has covered them in great detail. I think one of the big differences that the psychologists have done to influence the psychiatrists is stop the classification as you are or you aren't. It's called the taxonomic or classificatory versus the dimensional system. And basically what it means is the psychiatrist would want to say he is or he is not a psychopath, that you either are or you are not. Whereas we've always argued that this is a dimension and that people are slightly or more or extremely psychopathic. And the abiding characteristic of a psychopath is not lack of empathy, which most people talk about, but it's lack of conscience. And can you imagine how much fun you could have for the next couple of days without a conscience? If you are, as I said before, if you are good-looking and articulate and educated and boisterous and bold and a psychopath, you can do particularly well because of the courage that comes with psychopaths. They go where other people dare not go. They shake the tree. They, as Americans say, they're happy to kick ass. And many organizations really seek these people out. They're thought of as heroes who come into the organization and kick ass. The trouble is they're kicking ass for their own benefits, not for the organization's benefits.
Adrian, you have a chapter on arrogance, hubris, and narcissism where you particularly talk about politicians. Is it possible that we need a few arrogant, hubristic, and narcissistic leaders from time to time?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think, you know, of the many leaders we've had that are well known, Churchill and Thatcher would be two which come to mind, and both were, in their own way, rather hubristic. And I think the answer is they were both leaders for major change. Churchill was a leader for war, who didn't do very well in peacetime, and even though he was elected after the war, wasn't very successful. He was, I think, a hubristic man, and so was the Blessed Margaret, who I remember talking to her personally about these sort of issues. You need an enormous amount of confidence to do stuff, to go to war, to take these amazing decisions. The trouble is, if you're successful, I always think success is a very bad teacher, that if you've been very successful, you assume that the success is a consequence entirely of your own good judgment. And of course, we saw that in Hitler as well. And that over time, this success and these judgments of success combined with fawning acolytes leads people to a position of hubris. David Owen, Lord David Owen, has founded the Hubris Foundation, and indeed it's all about hubristic politicians. And
I'm sorry, to encourage or discourage?
Well, I think discourage, or at least give them some insight into their hubris. When you meet people, for instance, in the fashion business, you're astonished by their pathological hubris, which is curiously reinforced by their supporters.
It's the most fascinating area, isn't it? How to identify the dark side of a leader of a corporation or a country. And you also link the illnesses of famous politicians in your book, or rather you describe them. I've known a number of Australian political leaders who had, you know, suffered from maternal back pain or migraines, yes, and so on. Is this a factor?
It can be, I think. The back pain, I mean, Kennedy had very serious back pain. I was, you know, and had great difficulty walking. He was given lots of injections to solve this. I think there are two types of illnesses. Of course, there are sort of physical illnesses like high blood pressure or whatever, although that could be seen as psychosomatic. And there are psychological illnesses. A number of politicians who have been identified with these illnesses have been associated with alcoholism, drug dependency. A surprising number who were bipolar. Churchill was thought to be manic depressive. And of course, it's the stages of mania that allow them to do things as opposed to the stages of depression. It was said that Tricky Dicky Nixon was seriously paranoid. And there are, I think you can go back in history and see a number of significant physical and mental illnesses which must have affected the judgment of these politicians.
A last question. Is it harder for these characters, whether they're in politics or corporate life, is it harder for them to get away with now that everyone is subject to such relentless analysis by the media?
No, I think it's much less easy for them to get away with it. I think, you know, I don't envy their jobs personally, but you're under astonishing scrutiny all the time through all sorts of media, and that, you know, your faults and your peculiarities and your peccadilloes are much more likely to be picked up. If you simply, as I said before, if you go to the web and you want to scrape some stuff off off the web for some individuals reaching way back to their past, you'll be astonished what you can find. And I think, you know, the job of taking on leadership roles is harder than ever because of these reasons, because of social media.
Well, we checked you out very thoroughly and couldn't find any fault in you. Not a single peccadillo. So, Adrian, thanks for that. Adrian Fernham, Professor of Psychology, University College London. Oh, adjunct Professor of Management at the Norwegian School of Management, and we know how well Norway manages. And his book is Backstabbers and Bullies, was to be, and Bastards, How to Cope with the Dark Side of People at Work, and it's published by Bloomsbury. My guest, Professor Adrian Fernham, author of Backstabbers and Bullies.